This is an interview with David Clapp for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. The date's April 21st, 2014, and we are at his house in Florida. I should note before we get started that Mr. Clapp participated in a fireside chat on April 28th, 2011 with Ronald Stack, moderated by Lisa Fairfax, on the issue of pay-to-play, and that also is available at the Virtual Museum and Archive of the Historical Society. So thank you very much for agreeing to speak with us. We usually start with a little bit of personal background. Where are you from, for example?
I was born in New York City, actually, in Flushing, Long Island, and lived there for a long time. I mean, I lived there until I moved to New York City about 15 years ago. And moved out to out on Long Island, to Manhasset, Long Island, and that's that. I mean, I went to school in Manhasset. I went to high school in Kent, Connecticut at the Kent School. And I went to college at Yale.
Yeah, what did you study there?
English.
English.
English literature.
And then did you go directly into your work after that?
Yeah, I did. I left after I graduated.
What year was that?
1960.
Okay.
After I graduated, I went to work right away at a firm where my father was connected, and I didn't go into any business. I went really to the back office and stayed in the back office for quite a while, actually, several years. And then
this is a finance firm?
Yeah, it was R.W. Prestwich & Company. It still exists, although it's not the same firm. The fact is someone bought the name at some point. And then, somewhere along the line, I forget, I don't remember, the year was 1974, I had been working as a financial advisor in New York at Prestwich, and we had lots of clients, among them the New York State Dormitory Authority, and I came to know a man named Gus Levy, who ran Goldman Sachs, and helped that his hospital, Mount Sinai, get themselves out of trouble during the New York City crisis of 1974-5. And he liked me so much, he hired me.
So you've been in municipal security. When did you get into that?
I was in it then, but not on the underwriting side. We had a financial advisory practice, and at first I sort of ran that.
Okay, but you were working on other kinds of securities as well?
I was doing some other kinds of bond work, particularly in public finance, treasury bond work and stuff like that. But I liked the municipal bond business. I liked the people, and I liked the feel of it. And I'd had other family members in it. So, and Gus wanted me to come to Goldman Sachs and work in the municipal bond business, where they were just growing their business.
Okay, so that had started fairly recently then, or was it...
It had started a while before, but it was sort of a small corner of what Goldman Sachs did. So he decided that he thought it was a great business and that they should do more of it. And so he hired me, and I joined another friend of mine who already worked there in the business, and... you know, we had a small apartment at the time, mm-hmm. but we grew over a period of time, and Gus was very enthusiastic about it. He had a heart attack, a stroke, excuse me, at a meeting of the Port of New York Authority, where he'd been a member for a while, and died in 1976, I believe. But the firm then was taken over by John Weinberg and John Whitehead, and they loved the business too, so we just kept rolling along.
So what did your work involve?
Well, it was I was mostly in the finance end of it. At that point, a business which had largely been involved competitively bid bond issues began to switch over to negotiated bond business because issuers were selling larger and larger issues, and some of the ratings were, you know, between BBB and A-minus, et cetera. They wanted to put together an investment banking group to give him an offering on a specific debt. So I really, that's what I really centered on, is building up the that business.
Let me ask you about your view of the crisis in New York, and particularly in the period leading up to that.
I'm very connected to it because I worked on it from Goldman Sachs. And I think what happened was, and it was happening not just in New York, although the New York problem probably threatened to spill all over the country, was that people were buying note issues and bond issues of municipalities such as New York City that obviously, if you look closely enough, had some rather large financial difficulties, couldn't do their budgets, couldn't get, you know, where they needed to get on time. And then one day, the banks refused to roll over New York City's, I think it was $1 billion worth of notes. And when you don't roll over notes, you're hurtling towards default. So a group of us got together with the governor, Hugh Carey, who's, by the way, my hero. Everybody says it's Felix Rowett, the hero was Hugh Carey, who was then governor.
Be sure and tell me a little bit about why you think so.
Because he got everybody together and said, this is what's going to happen.
Okay.
Clap, you're going to go to Seattle and Portland. You're going to go here, you're going to go there. It was us, Solomon Brothers, First Boston, I think what was then Blythe and Company, I don't know, a couple of other firms. And we put together a group of people. In the meantime, they were writing legislation to pass the,
the MAC, or?
Yeah, MAC.
Yeah.
Municipal Assistance Corporation. And which actually made it pretty easy because to get out and sell stuff to people, because when you get right down to it, all the revenue power of New York State was behind it. And they put into effect rules and regulations, etc. And people don't realize this, but New York City is, well, some people do, of course, is one of the safest investments there is. Because no matter how bad you think it looks, the first dollars every year go into the bond fund. They can't pay anything else till the bond fund is filled. And that's, if you take a look at, even in bad years, if you take a look at the cash flow of New York City, it's a huge amount of money. So we were able to get that deal going, and then...
That's as a consequence of this legislation?
That is as a consequence of that legislation. And also, the other thing that was going on was... they were putting together things behind some of the other state issuers, like the New York State Dormitory Authority, the Housing Finance Agency, et cetera, et cetera. And if any one of those would have defaulted, it would have been the end. I mean, the whole thing would have collapsed. And then there were other states that were sort of, Pennsylvania in particular, others who had some problems. In those days, California was very strong. Illinois and those places didn't really have any particular problems. It was basically a New York problem. So when you go to Seattle and sit down and say, I'm going to sell you guys New York City bonds, everybody looks at us and goes, you guys are nuts. How'd you like to get out of here? So it wasn't easy, but it turned out to be pretty easy.
Let me ask you a little bit about your experience of the municipal securities market in general. It was known for having very few defaults. Trades after the initial issuance were quite rare.
Well, there was a big secondary market then.
Yeah.
Because remember, even then there was well over $2 trillion outstanding. So now it's well over $3 I always thought that the municipal market was a kind of dull market, really. A lot of school district bonds, loving. And it wasn't until we got into the big negotiated finance deals, highways, bridges, you know, tunnels, and then large healthcare and higher education authorities, that the secondary market really took off. And there's a sort of a backstop to the municipals that people forget about, I think, sometimes. And that is that banks, trust companies, people who have trust in states and et cetera, normally put a percentage, sometimes a large percentage, into municipal bonds. It's supposed to be a hedge against, which it hasn't always been, but it's supposed to be a hedge against the stock market collapsing or something else. And I thought that it was a pretty good marketplace. It didn't have the kinds of disclosure it needed, and I worked on that later, but it didn't have the kind of disclosure it needed, and it had a bunch of small dealers around the country who basically would pay to get deals. Mm-hmm. If you buy a $10 million deal and it costs you $100,000 to buy that business, so what? You're making a lot of dough. You got a $10 million deal, less $100,000. You know, so that became a growing problem in that business. But for a long time, if you take the New York Power Authority, the New York Port Authority, big places like some of the big power issuers in the West, those were big financings for their day. I remember I did a Mississippi Highway issue once, refunding. And it was like 400 million. It was the second biggest deal ever done, 400 million. It was like, well, it was big for those days. So, and more people got into the business, and some got out. First Boston got out of the business. Solomon Brothers got out of the business because they didn't think they were making any money in it. A couple other guys got out of it, but a lot of other firms actually beefed up what they were doing. The banks, of course, could not buy revenue bonds, or they had to buy general obligation bonds, and couldn't do revenue bonds, basically because of Glass-Steagall. And then,
the revenue bonds were becoming more and more.
They became a major part of the market at that point, but they wanted to get in on that business because they saw that it was lucrative. But they were stopped by Glass-Steagall until Congress passed a law that basically eviscerated Glass-Steagall, took it all apart. And at first
this is in the late 90s now.
Yeah. 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 Before that, that was, I don't remember exactly the year. But then they could bid on, and you know, because they had a lot of, they were able to be major factors in the business, and they hired away a lot of good people from the investment banking firms that had departments, and we all got offered jobs. But banks in those days didn't know how to pay anyone. You told them what you thought you ought to make, they looked at you like you're crazy. No one in the bank was making anything like that money, except maybe the chairman, the president, and a few other guys.
Right. So tell me a little bit more about the relationship between some of the big firms, and you were mentioning some of the more regional people who you kind of hinted were at the beginnings of political contributions.
Yeah, they were, you know, but I don't want to... I just gave you an example that is a truism. It's not, I don't know of a specific example like that. The relationships between the firms was not bad at all. Some of my best friends were at Solomon Brothers. They were heated rivals, but we were good pals, and we worked hard together. So I had some other good friends at First Boston that was then in the business. And all of us had clients that we sort of were stronger in than others of us, and some firms were stronger in some parts of the country than others. Then the larger regional firms began to get into the business. And they had always participated in the municipal bond business locally and even nationally as members of syndicates. But suddenly they said, well, we can run these deals. And they, because they had friends among the politicians and various other things, they got appointed to deals, to run deals. And, you know, and so did we. I mean, it was pretty competitive. It was. I mean, we at Goldman Sachs moved up to number one in the business at some point along there and stayed there for quite a while. But there were other guys who did very well. And in fact, Morgan Guaranty Trust was a big player in the business long before the Chase thing. And trying to think of who else I would say was major players. The firms that had been the bracket of the stock deals were also the biggest guys in municipals, to the extent that they wanted to be, and some didn't, but. I was always intrigued by Salomon Brothers because it was a trading firm. Really, it was a trading firm. And then eventually they got into investment banking and got big investment banking clients. And they had a very strong municipal bond department. In fact, so strong that when they closed the business, I hired about three or four of them to come over to Goldman Sachs. And they did very well. Well for me, well for the firm, well for themselves.
About how many people would have been involved in that part of the business?
At Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, at Goldman Sachs.
It would have grown over a period of time. When I was running the department near the end, it was all told, trading, underwriting, analysts, investment bankers. It was somewhere around 90 people. But it had grown a lot over the years. We were bigger, say, than the Salomon Brothers group, but not as big as, say, the First Boston group and some others. Some of those, when the business began to have some troubles, when interest rates went sky high, et cetera, and nobody was making any money, some people just decided it was time to get out of the business, First Boston being one. Solomon being another.
And then what are we thinking about here? Is this? I've sometimes heard the early 80s is characterized by the high interest rates.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I always thought we made more money in bad markets than we did in good because our spreads were higher, and I thought we could make just more money by being in those kinds of deals. I mean, I sold bond issues where the 30-year bond was 13%. Tax-exempt 13%, you know. And people loved them. I loved them. Mm-hmm. Of course, as rates came down, they all got refunded or exchanged, etc. But, you know, it was still a big, robust business. I'm trying to think of when the MSRB came into being.
75?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the time I was on the MSRB, it was doing good work, but it had not done anything to stop political contribution scandals, and it had not really gotten into some of the nitty-gritty that it needed to in terms of disclosure. I mean, after all, it was made up of people from the business. Mm-hmm. It was in the SEC, but it was made up of people in the municipal bond business. Issuers, investment bankers, traders, and even an occasional analyst.
I was just talking to Kit Taylor last week, actually.
Oh, yeah? He's an old friend.
Yeah, yeah. He talked a little bit about you in his interview and your travails, but we'll get to those eventually. So I want to ask you, actually, about the experience of working in what is was famously an opaque market. But first I want to ask about the place of municipal securities within Goldman Sachs in general, because it was known for being kind of a peculiar...
It was a peculiar fit, but because of Gus, who was a member of the Port Authority and very, very close to Nelson Rockefeller, to the point where when he died and we went to his funeral, Nelson Rockefeller was giving a eulogy and cried. But it got pretty big in the firm, and that's because we became a significant percentage of the firm's bottom line. Not as big as investment banking, and not as big as if you took all of security sales and lumped them together. But it was a substantial business within the firm. So nobody ever complained about it. Everybody liked it a lot. And then, you know, after Gus, John Weinberg, who was trustee of several hospitals, John Whitehead, who was on the board of colleges, and they all began to get, they got a lot of feel for it and liked it better. And they were succeeded by Bob Rubin, who became Treasury Secretary and various other things, and Steve Friedman, who also was connected. So everybody liked the business. And then it's, you know, in later days, it started to dwindle because spreads were smaller and there was so much competition. Mm-hmm. It was ridiculous. You can look in the New York Times every Monday about what's selling that week, and it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Little firms in Virginia and somewhere else, you know.
So you're doing a lot of negotiated bond sales. At the same time, there's not a lot of disclosure in the market. Could you tell me a little bit about the process of negotiation?
We did official statements, you know. And we did do a lot of due diligence before we accepted the client. The official statements were pretty good in describing the business of the bond issuer, et cetera, et cetera. There were two problems. One is nobody read them. Mm-hmm. They just, you know, they just didn't read them. They thought, oh, let's just say that stuff. This is Goldman's deal. We don't care. There was that problem. Another problem was that in the aftermarket, disclosure just disappeared. There was nothing. Nothing came out. There were some requirements to provide annual reports and things like that. But you know, accounting for tax-exempt organizations is pretty weird. It's really fund accounting. So a lot of people just couldn't understand, make head or tails out of it. So partially because of the MSRB, partially because of some people at the SEC, and et cetera, the kinds of disclosures started to increase, although there still wasn't really enough of a requirement for it.
Yeah, I mean, you start even with that basic level of CUSIP numbers in the late 70s.
Yeah, it's just to say that
build slowly up from there.
Dullest job in the world, mm-hmm. to tell your parents. What are you going to do after college? Oh, I'm still going to go to work for CUSIP. So anyway, you're right. That's actually a good point. That's really where it sort of got underway, and it began to get to the point where people could identify one bond issue from another. I think actually that the purchasers of bonds, particularly institutions, probably in casualty companies and others, also wanted more of it because they, you know, they felt they had a fiduciary, much more of a fiduciary duty toward what they were doing than, say, a stockbroker does to his customer who does a couple of hundred bonds every 3 years with him. So I think it was sort of a joint effort, and we felt like we thought we were sort of in the forefront of drafting bond resolutions, which are indentures, really, to provide for requirements along those lines and cash flows that took into account that kind of thing. And we thought we were, and some other firms were good too, we thought we were right in the forefront of requiring this kind of thing. So, you know, and the MSRB was helpful. It it worked on a lot of things that didn't matter that much and had not taken on pay-for-play yet. And it's fair to say, I think, that pay-for-play hadn't really blossomed as big as it finally got
yet.
Had not blossomed as big as it got because the bond issues weren't big enough. You know, getting left off a management team was not the end of the world. But the business itself had taken over as the major train in the municipal business and the competitive deals. A lot of competitive deals were required by law.
Mm-hmm.
So people had to do competitive deals. So they thought of ways around it. They created state agencies and other things that were sort of, you know, then they didn't have to do competitive deals with the state agencies. But the fact that these deals had gotten so big and the spreads were so big, the example I gave, while not an actual example, is very similar to what would happen. And if you'd go into a town, a city, I won't name one, and you ran into the local dealers, their attitude was, get out of here. I'm going to make sure you not only don't do this deal, you don't do any business here. Not all the time, but a lot of times. Then some of them would come to us and say, come on in. You and me are going to do all this business. So you've got to be, you know, it's got to be pretty good. The one thing about the municipal bond municipal business that I think people don't concentrate on quite enough is that the quality of the people, for the most part, working in municipal government in this country is very good. They're honest people. They don't get paid a lot. They understand their businesses, how the government works, and what they have to do. There's crooks, of course, and some bad ones. But generally speaking, my experience was very good with those people over the years. I mean, just great guys, great women. And, by the way, because women kept getting elected suddenly and appointing women, firms started to hire women. What a surprise, you know. And so I think there was that to me was a good development that kind of came along with the business, that grew up in the business.
Yeah, it was really one of the earlier areas to include women, yes?
Yes, it was. That and minority groups. And Doug did have a lot to... Well, I think that I hired women because we were mostly, not only, but mostly hiring from business schools. And a lot of them were interested in public finance. And they simply seemed to be more talented than a lot of the men that we would interview. That was one thing. And then the other thing was, of course, the women started getting elected mayors of cities and this, that, and the other thing. And minority guys did. Principally African Americans. And they wanted to hire African Americans to do their deals. So everybody sort of felt, you know, kind of went along and looked to hire people like that. And some of those guys did really fabulously well, including Gar Wood, who was my partner, who was a partner at Goldman Sachs. First African-American partner at Goldman Sachs. God rest him. He's gone. But
when was the big change? The 70s or the 80s?
It was the late 70s and into the 80s. But the time came, and I can't tell you exactly the year, when it didn't ever occur to us, to anymore, at least us, that we wouldn't hire somebody because they were black or Chinese or a woman. You know, I mean, it got off the table as a consideration, which I think was a good thing. And I think we were way ahead of corporate America, way ahead. And it was the client banker relationship that I think helped that. I mean, even the southern firms fell in line and, you know, started to hire particularly African Americans, but also women, although not as many women.
I want to ask about a couple of things. One might be going back to the earlier phase of your career, which is before the 1969 Tax Reform Act, there were still arbitrage bonds. I don't think I'll talk to anybody else who might be able to tell me about the period before that. Did you have any experience?
Sure, we did arbitrage bonds.
Yeah.
We did, in fact, before 69, and even after 69, the law was not sharp enough so that, for instance, I did a $300 million deal for Harvard to build a power plant. And I did it short term because the long term rates were so high. Mm-hmm. And I kept rolling them over and over. And the Harvard board, which is only seven guys, said, "This is pretty good. We can do this for 30 years. I said, "You're not going to be able to." And finally, a law was passed, was known as the Harvard Law, because I made something like, they made something like $15 million, $15 or $20 million just rolling these deals and not having them long. Then we took it out long. By then, interest rates had come way down. And Harvard was AAA, so there was never going to be any problem. But arbitrage bonds were just a fact of life. You know, you could... I'm not sure. I mean, some people I didn't think should do them, just like I didn't think some municipalities should do short-term financing because I didn't trust necessarily their ability to roll it out into long-term financing when the time came. And but then the rules changed and the laws changed and the arbitrage bonds went bye-bye, and it was. There are still a version of it going on, but it's not really like it was in those days.
And in the early 90s, the controversy or the scandal, if you will, around yield burning sets in. And there's quite a gap there between the two.
Yeah, what's the yield burning? What was what I'm trying to think.
That was when the broker-dealers benefit from the arbitrage, the anti-arbitrage laws.
Oh, yeah.
Well, rather than the municipalities.
Yeah, I don't know what to... That's what was really bad. I'd sort of forgotten about that. Mm. I knew the term when you said yield burning, but I didn't remember what it was about. That guys in New York weren't doing this, believe me.
Yeah.
So it was... but that was...
Is it a parochial thing?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's just like I was looking one time at... I was doing some sort of a health care deal down in Alabama, I believe. And they told me that they wanted to hire, as their underwriter's counsel, two law firms. Well, there were law firms that one guy did divorces and the other guy... So I said, well, they're not qualified. And he said, to us, they're qualified. I said, okay, they're going to add to you. We're going to put it into your expenses and make your bond issue bigger. That's okay, it's okay. So, you know, I've forgotten about yield burning.
Yeah. This might sink into another area, industrial development bonds, which, of course, became a bigger and bigger thing as time went on.
Industrial development bonds were the other, and I should have mentioned this, were the other thing that made the business grow so big and made some of the senior partners of firms in New York be interested, because their clients, the companies, could do tax-exempt bond deals. And, of course, in the beginning, they could do any size they could do. Then it got limited, the size they could do. But Goldman Sachs was always very high up on the league tables in that kind of thing, because we had probably more corporate clients than anyone else. And even if a corporate client was on a board of a hospital in Cincinnati, he'd call up his pal, who was my boss, and said, this hospital one needs to do a $40 million bond deal. Could you guys do it? You know, so I'd travel out and we'd do it. Or at least we'd see if we could do it.
So let me ask about...
But the industrial revenue bonds, they were huge, and almost any firm could do it. And a lot of them were smallish, and a lot of, you know, smallish meaning... somewhere between 1 and 6 or 7 million. And they had pretty good ratings. Although, somebody, I think it was Moody's, maybe it was either Standard & Poor's or Moody's, would not rate them, which is was a very interesting. That was a purist attitude toward the whole thing. I think it was Moody's who said, we're not going to rate these. So, you know, it didn't hurt anybody or anything.
Was it apparent that there was eventually going to be a clampdown on the sorts of things that...
There was to me.
Yeah.
There was to me because... And I think there was... I wasn't the only one. I think people came to the point of thinking, you know, this is really sort of an abuse of the tax code. It wasn't considered such in the beginning because the lawyer said it isn't. And every state would pass laws allowing these kinds of bonds to be done. So, you know, I felt like... I didn't have strong feelings that it would get crushed. But I thought that once the ball was rolling... Under those administrations who wanted to reform taxes, that it was probably going to be hard to stop it from getting into these things. You know, you can now do them taxable. And then the companies deduct. You know, you can't deduct. It's a strange thing in a way, but it makes sense that if you want to do a deal because you want to build a plant somewhere, you got to do the deal. It doesn't matter if it's tax exempt, you're going to have lower interest rates. But if it's taxable, you're going to have a bigger tax deduction if you're the company. So it's, you know.
I want to ask about the impact of the 1986 Tax Reform Act. But before I get to that, I want to ask about perceptions of risk in this market, whether or not they were affected by things like the replacement of general obligation bonds, by revenue bonds, or by the headline issues such as the Whoops case?
I would say this. I would say that the things like the Whoops thing made people look a lot closer at where the bond issues were being issued and who was issuing them. State of Washington was basically for sale, my opinion. And they were selling all this power to Los Angeles. And they were building, you know, billions of dollars worth of plants. So I felt as though that was a big thing. There were a couple of other big things. There were some out-and-out defaults that occurred. But I think that... So what else did you say you were talking about?
The rise of revenue bonds over general
obligation. I don't know how much influence that had on the market as a whole. I mean, most people... The big trick in revenue bonds were if you were selling a revenue bond, you'd take a look at something called coverage. How much does revenues, net revenues, cover expenses by, including debt service? And if revenues, and there was a sort of a rule that anything well below 1.5 times coverage was sort of risky, but that went by the wayside when, in the most recent financial crisis, when as long as you matched up, you could sell stuff. You know, collateralized debt obligations didn't have any coverage; they're there. The Whoops bonds actually made people think that the contracts, which said you had to pay no matter what happened, were not worth anything because municipalities would just say, I'm not paying. What are you going to do to me? And it was those kinds of things that got people thinking more seriously about what's behind these things. And don't forget, Whoops did a lot of bonds mm-hmm. over a lot of years. And we were in a couple of those deals. I actually didn't have very much to do with it. But we were in a couple of them, and several of them. And, you know, most of these contracts for electric power issuers had contracts with the bondholders, had a contract essentially that said, you forget exactly the phrase, but you got to pay. It doesn't matter. You got to pay your debt service. And then the courts in Washington said, we see something here that these poor people didn't know was going to happen.
These are the chemical bank cases?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't think you do have to pay. So, I mean, everybody went nuts. And I thought to myself, a woman out there playing is someone I know.
On the golf course?
I can always recognize her by her hair. She's got a pro with her. Anyway, so that was, I would say Whoops was a bigger, more difficult thing than New York City and those things, because Whoops called into question the whole way people were doing business in these contracts that they were that the businesses were based on. Whereas New York, they passed legislation and it moved on, and it's now a solid A-rated credit, even though nobody would say it's the most wonderful thing in the world, because it's New York City and it's big and it's unwieldy and et cetera.
Could you tell me a little bit about the reintegration of New York into the commercial market? If that's the right way of putting it.
The bonds?
Yeah.
Several years went by, and then the mayor, they decided Merrill Lynch and we would run the first deal as a negotiated deal. We started with $75 million. We moved it up to $100 million, and it went mm-hmm. right out the window. I mean, the yields were big, and there were a lot of people who wouldn't buy them still. But, time went on, and based on Mac was selling a lot of bonds at that point, and those were pretty doing well, too. And other issuers were related to New York, were sort of back in the market, and like the Dormitory Authority and the State Housing Finance Agency. Those guys were out of the market for a while. Just, there was no way they could sell anything. I remember I sold one deal for the museum of the Metropolitan Museum in New York. So I made them put up enough endowment to cover debt service. Not to make any money on an arbitrage basis, just to cover debt service. And they told them, the rate in the end can't be any higher than the rate on the bonds, otherwise it would be an arbitrage bond. And they were like, okay, well, we'll do that, because they have plenty of endowment. And so at that point, New York was pretty reintegrated. I mean, it was just sold regularly. Sometimes the deals were too big and didn't do as well as other times. And we and Merrill Lynch ran the deals back and forth for a long time. And in the end, it has become a regular market player and still is.
Okay, why don't we talk about 1986 then? I've heard a couple of things. First, the rush to get in issues before that, and then, of course, the day that Bob Packwood shut the market down. And I'm kind of curious about your memories.
Well, I mean, my memory of it is probably less clear than some people. I mean, there was a date named, and you had to get in before it, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And the Packwood thing, I don't know if I ever even thought very much about it, to tell you the truth. But what we did do, what everybody did do, was rush in to mm-hmm. get their deals done. And I remember thinking, well, it's, you know, this is the way it, this is sort of, it was sort of the thing I was thinking of long before it was going to come, actually, tell you the truth. And I remember I met with Abraham Ribicoff, who I knew pretty well, and he said to me, this is just coming. There's no way you can do anything about it. And at that point, he was...
What are we referring to specifically when we say this?
The tax law.
Okay.
And somewhere along the line, people got to thinking that only very rich people like Mrs. Dodge were buying municipals, and that wasn't fair to the little guy, when in reality, the biggest buyer of them were mutual funds. And which were selling to all kinds of people, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it became sort of a political thing to be able to be involved with that politicians, elected officials liked. Because if you owned them, they weren't going to make you retroactively taxable. And if you didn't own them, they would just sell at higher rates, and you could buy them then or not. You know, I mean, it was like it was sort of a no-brainer if you were a politician to support it or not at least be against it. But I didn't feel like at the time, and I think I was right, that it was going to have such a big, much of an overall effect on the size of the market and who the buyers were and everything else. I mean, remember we lost the casualty companies. Because their tax situation changed, i.e., they didn't owe any. You know, so it became sort of a thing where, in my opinion, anyway, the law changed. Everybody thought it was probably going to, and then time just moved on. And I don't even remember the big rush. The worst was a big rush, though, to get in. Sorry, some of these things are a little fuzzy.
Sure, no problem. It's sometimes considered to be a tipping point towards the dominance of the retail investor. Was that your perception? First, let me ask you...
The big investors were mutual funds.
Yeah.
Which is just... a retail investor by another name.
Yeah, already by that
yeah.
point. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, there were big insurance companies and banks that bought them, and there were banks that had to buy them, that needed to buy them because they needed to provide them for people who had wills and this, that, and the other thing. But actually, I think that... In a matter of fact, I think the retail market was big before that. I think the little home, you know, little firms, Edward James and Company and these guys, were selling municipals. Not in huge amounts, but people loved their municipals. Mm. You just bought them and you got paid interest. And, you know, and when interest rates went up because of things like whatever effect Whoops had on it, I don't know, New York City, people didn't mind. They just... continued to buy them. They trusted their brokers too, mm-hmm. not to tell them bad stuff.
Now, this is also the time when there's more seriousness surrounding disclosure with the enacting of Rule 15C212 and MSRB creates its missile system.
Yeah.
I don't know what effect that would have had on your business.
It didn't have much effect on the business. It just meant there was a little more work for people trying to do deals and a little more, and they needed to get really into disclosure and to understand mm-hmm. what it meant, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it meant more money and work for the lawyers who would say, no, this doesn't really comport.
Mm-hmm.
But my own feeling was all these things really expanded the market. And the other thing that expanded the market in a strange kind of a way were the bond insurers who came along. I mean, full disclosure, I was a director of MBIA for many years. But because people love to buy these insurance things, and the difference in yield between an insured bond and a bond that wasn't insured totally had to do with the underlying interest. If the underlying rating was A or double A, there wasn't that big a difference. Even though the bond would jump up to a triple A, it was an insured triple A. So, you know, people didn't want to test the fact of what would happen if something went wrong. Although they should have, because each one of those insurance companies was strong enough to be able to meet those kinds of payments.
Other factors in the continuing growth of the market coming into the 1990s. I was reading an old article, I think, Bond Buyer, Wall Street Journal or something like that, in which you were quoted, talking about privatization. I don't know if that was a bit of a one-off or if that was a continual.
Everybody thought, this is going to be good, man. Took all these things and make them private. Well, everybody did a few. And I thought privatization was a good idea for some people. But even today, it hasn't taken on much of a... It doesn't... I mean, you know, California's trying to do their toll road, to their roads this way.
Mm-hmm.
Other people are trying to do these things. But... I was quoted, what did I say? This is the coming future. I can feel it in my bones.
So there are a lot more complex products coming out around these this time as well. You start to have the VRDOs, interest rate swaps. You mentioned bond insurance, of course.
Yeah, which was not complicated at all.
No.
But it was just... variable rate demand notes and variable rate turned out to be a creature of the yield curve. I mean, you know, and then when the yield curve had problems, they weren't as popular with people because people were afraid. Because you also had commercial paper, municipal commercial paper at that point. And it grew into a very large business, still is. I wouldn't do commercial trade. This is a long time ago. It has nothing to do with the current problems. But I wouldn't do a commercial paper deal for Detroit because I was afraid we couldn't roll over that paper. Detroit was nowhere near defaulting at that point. And, you know, the mayor called me up and he said, please, I'm begging you. I said, Mayor, I'm sorry, I can't do it. So, and a lot of other people turned down some of these deals, and he wound up doing bank loans and a bond issue and not trying to do it anymore. Those kinds of things brought into the business a new class of people who were more mathematically oriented and et cetera. Because at the same time, all of our computer capabilities were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. One of the biggest jokes in the world was at Goldman Sachs. There was a time when I was the most computer literate guy in the department. That makes people fall on the floor laughing. Later, I was not, but I mean, at that point, I paid a little attention to it. So I was. But all these things made these things easier to do. And you could do things like student loan deals because you can now run numbers. And it wouldn't matter if the numbers you ran were not going to ever come true. It would matter if you could convince the rating services that the numbers you ran were reasonable enough so that they could rate it, because it would have to be much worse for it to get into trouble.
And as far as the issuer's ability to deal with sophisticated, for example, I've heard that New York by this time is actually quite good at doing very complex deals.
Very good. Very
yes.
Good. Investment bankers, we were all good. And a couple of the guys, both in the controller's office and in the budget, the the mayor's side. You know, we're all the top people were very good, very strong, understood it, spent a lot of time studying it and getting to know what it was. And, you know, this just goes to, I mean, to me, it went to show me these are strong people. They didn't want to leave the government. I don't know why. You know, 90% of all people become a policeman because of the pension. And I don't think that was true of these people. I think they just like public service. Mm-hmm. And they get paid not very well, but they get paid well enough for them. And so some very strong people. Some got hired. I hired a couple people away from the rating services, several. And I hired some people away from some municipal entities across the country. Not many, but a few. And I hired some lawyers from bond firms, bond law firms.
And as far as across the spectrum of issuers, I mean, I've also heard that it's quite uneven, so that New York is an exemplary case, whereas there are a lot of people who really weren't prepared to deal with swaps.
I can say that certainly there were some people who just didn't understand it and didn't want to do it. And that you'd have to, if you thought that, you know, you had to be very careful. If you pushed too hard, the issue would finally, his trust in you mm-hmm. would begin to dwindle as time went on. He said, all this guy's going to do is do it. He wants to do is a deal, and he's trying to sell me these deals, and I don't think I understand him. I always said, and I'll say it to this day, if I don't understand it, I'm not doing it. You know, it's mm-hmm. just that simple. So that, and when I was at MBIA, I remember they were getting into some products, and I said, listen, said to the chairman in a board meeting, I don't get it, and so I can't support it. You guys can vote me down, but I can't support it because I don't understand it. Which usually works to slow some people down. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that New York was that far. I mean, I'll tell you who were good. There were people like at the Salt River Project, the big public power issuer in Arizona, the people at the New York Power Authority. They were good. They were good. There were some good people up in Boston. There's some pretty good people who, you know, just depended on what was the makeup of the people who'd be given these responsibilities at that point. Who were they? Where'd they come from? Yeah, I guess New York was ahead. I mean, it was better.
Well, let me shift gears a little bit and ask how you came to be involved with the MSRB. Had you had many dealings with them before you ended up on the board?
Oh, not really. I mean, I was pretty well known in the industry, and every year you go in for a 3-year term. Mm-hmm. So the thing is,
it was around this time that you actually became in charge of municipal securities at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, it was. It was. I don't exactly remember. I mean, I ran the finance, public finance business, and then in the end, when Bob Downey retired, I ran the whole thing. I guess that's right. My memory is not exactly clear, but I went on the MSRB, and I was on a year, and the chairman called me up.
Were you asked to be on the MSRB?
Yeah, you're asked. Mm-hmm. You're asked. They elect you mm-hmm. to it, and then you, you can't. You can't.
You can't
campaign for it
to be on,
or you can't campaign for it. Yeah. So,
who is it who does the asking?
The board itself. Board. Yeah, it's usually either Kit was like Kit, or myself when I was the chairman, or somebody.
Right.
So we, you know, I went on, and I was on for a year, and then there were a couple of guys who were going to be third-year guys who said they couldn't become the chairman for some reason or other. So they asked me, even though I was only going into my second year. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And it was very enjoyable. I liked it a lot. I liked the work. I liked the people. I like dealing with the SEC. I loved dealing with my old pal, Arthur Leavitt, who was then controller of New York. And then became SEC chairman after that. And I liked dealing with...
That's New York State, right?
New York State, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Arthur. And then... And Arthur was head of the New American Stock Exchange at one point, too. Let's see. It was in that second year that the pay-for-play thing blossomed fully.
You'd already had a pretty strong interest in it, but because you really encountered that culture.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we should go back and talk about that a little bit. I mean, you've told stories in the Fireside Chat.
So. Yeah, I got bribed.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of times, or attempted bribes. And I thought to myself, this is really bad. This is going to blow this whole business up if we're not careful. And I wasn't on the MSRB board yet. But I remember turning people down, and they're saying to me, well, I'm sorry, you know, but you're just not going to be one of our managers. So I fought a little bit, and sometimes I won, and I said, all right, you know. These looked like reasonable requests when somebody said, can you support our dinner that we're having? But when the amounts got to be so big, it wasn't supportable by the facts, and it wasn't supportable by any reasonable way, like account, as to why anybody should pay them that much money. And some of the biggest deals I ever won, like the New York Power Authority, I didn't pay anybody. Nobody there in the New York Power Authority. I got to know the staff. We got to know the staff, and we knew the chairman, a guy named John Dyson, who was a friend of mine. And they picked us and Solomon and some other guys, and the subject never even came up. But for the elected officials in New York City, it was pretty egregious.
That was the famous case, right? Kit Taylor basically said that it was the election of the treasurer in New York City.
City controller.
Yeah.
She had been a congresswoman.
Okay.
Yeah. I was the one she went after.
Okay.
Through her campaign chairman. Whose name I can't remember. And she was a smart person. She was a good controller of the city. She was smart. And she was smart and kind. She's the one who... took over for the guy from Brooklyn. His name I can't remember. But anyway, she was running. She wasn't getting enough money. So, and I'm not even sure that it wasn't her campaign staff and campaign manager who didn't come up with this idea. I'm surprised Kit remembers. Well, Kit remembers practically everything. Wrote a rule, and it stunk. And I knew it stunk. We had to... The only test was that you had to...
Is this the one that... the draft where they were talking about the intent of the contribution?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we knew it stunk. So, we went to work on it again, changed it around, by then I was chairman, put in all the limits, and did all this, and did all that, did all the things that... That gave it some real bite. And then one day, the guy who was then running Morgan Stanley called me up, and I knew him, and he said, I just got kicked out of Massachusetts. I can't do any business in Massachusetts. I said, well, you don't want to do any business in Massachusetts. He said, wait a minute. He said, our guys are big in municipals in Massachusetts. Now they can't do any.
This is the famous case where the contribution was made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was innocent.
Yeah.
It was really actually innocent, but it broke the rule, and, lack of knowledge of the law is no excuse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and then it happened to a few other guys, and, it turned out that while it's not 100% effective and a lot of stuff is still going on, it's a shadow of what it was. Because people just... don't want to get that. First of all, people don't want the publicity, and I'm talking about the firms now and the banks. And secondly, the elected officials, you know, it's like a dry well. We said, we just can't go there much anymore because then they can give us anything. Mm-hmm. So the hell with them.
Yeah, I've heard from a few different people that this was generally well appreciated in the dealer community among the lawyers.
Of course it was. Yeah. And I was invited to speak at a treasurer's conference in Salt Lake City, I believe. And the people sitting in the room were treasurers or people who worked for treasurers. And when I got up on the podium, three quarters of them got up and left. A standing protest to me. It's a good moment, actually.
Mm-hmm. I mean, were you? I've heard that you were putting Goldman Sachs itself at some risk in being up in front on this.
I was, but I don't think very much so.
No,
I mean, we had a real in-house system with lawyers, and our lawyers, the in-house lawyers, did these rather carefully drafted memos and said, you cannot do this. Up to a certain amount, you can give as many of those as you want, providing it comports to federal law, do this, that, and the other thing, but you cannot do this. And I had some guys who, out in the field, out in the, you know, like Chicago, and said, this is nuts. I've been giving this guy $10,000 for years. I said, you can't. You just can't do it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing about the rule, is that there is no process leading up to the penalty. It's just automatic once
it is
the contribution is made.
Well, you can appeal it.
Yes.
But it'll immediately go to the end. You're out. You're not going to. You either made it or you didn't. Mm-hmm. Some guy said, well, if he gives me the money back? I said, aha, no good. Hmm. Doesn't work. Because, what's his name? He's a really good guy. Who was then the governor of Massachusetts? Bill Weld.
Mm-hmm.
He said, let me ask you this question. I was going down to Houston with him, I think it was, one day. He said, so if somebody makes a contribution he wasn't supposed to and you give it back, is there no harm? I said, yeah, there is harm. Because in the giving back, etc., there can be all kinds of finagling going on. And he got it. He said, oh, okay, I see. It's the act that gets you in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a process before you actually write the rule of getting the industry itself around.
To comment.
Yes. To comment, but also to try and voluntarily band together to exclude this from your practices. There's a famous meeting with Arthur Levitt and the big...
No, I called that meeting.
Okay.
Arthur, yeah. I got, you know, everybody was Dick Fold from Lehman. Mm-hmm. Said, what the fuck am I doing here? You know, I don't know anything about no Muslim missile. I had Steve Friedman with me. We had the guy who ran Merrill Lynch. And they were fine. They said, okay, we don't give a damn. We won't give any more contributions. I said, Steve, remember what you're saying now. I report to you. I run the municipal business, and you run the municipal business at the firm. You can't give any money. He said, then I won't. And folk, everybody got him and said, okay. That was a famous meeting in Arthur's office. You know, one of the real problems was, what's the name of the guy who worked for the bond buyer, that old reporter? He called me up and he said, I have to talk to you about this rule. And I have to get the permission to call you some other times. I said, why? He said, because Arthur Levitt doesn't understand it. He keeps contradicting himself and this, that, and the other thing. And I said, well, I don't think it's quite as bad as you say, I said, but remember, he's doing lots of other things in a day. But Arthur takes credit for being the author of the whole thing. And he certainly deserves a lot of credit, because no SEC chairman we'd ever had even thought about this. But his father had been controller of the state of New York 12 years in a row, 16, some incredibly long time. I said, him, it's his father, who was elected controller of the state over and over again. So he was aware of some of this. You know.
And he lent his full support to it, and that's a crucial thing.
Well, he also made it clear to those guys that he was behind it, and that the MSRB had the rule, but the rule had to be approved by the SEC, and the rule had been approved by the SEC, and now that's, as the court finally said, has the impact of law, and you can't do it anymore. Can I tell you, these guys didn't care. They didn't care. They didn't make contributions. Well, they can only make little ones, smaller ones. They didn't care.
Yeah. This may be a humorous aside since they didn't care, but the way Kit told this story, there was something that looked like a sign-in sheet, which was actually an agreement among the people in the meeting. Is that true?
Yeah. Probably not enforceable by law either.
Right.
But that was true. I forgot about that. Well, Kit, as I say, Kit would remember that. I had to call all these guys up and say, "Would you please come?" And they said, "What?" I said, "Look, either you say you're going to come, or I have to get over." And I didn't know a few of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did know Fold, and I did know some of them, but I didn't know a lot of them. So we had to. I said, "Either, or Arthur Levitt's going to call you."
Mm-hmm.
So they came one day. They all got on the shuttle. It was before anybody had private jets, really. And they all came down or came up or wherever they were coming from. It was so fun. It was funny. And Arthur said, "You know, this is the most, it's going to be the most important thing I do in my whole time at the SEC." And Steve Friedman looked at me. Gave me a look. I said, "Hey, he's the chairman." I saw Arthur recently. I take some really good courses at FAU, Florida Atlantic. And I sat down one day in a seat, and the guy next to me says, "Do I know you?" And it was Arthur. I said, "Arthur, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, I heard this was on Islam." Which it was.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "I don't know much about Islam. I thought I'd come and learn." I said, "Well, God, how are you doing?" "You know, I'm doing fine."
Does he live around here?
He doesn't. He was down visiting someone up at north of here.
I see.
And that person was signed up for this particular course, and Arthur came along.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got woken up one morning by Kit. He said, "Congratulations." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Supreme Court's refused to hear it."
This is the Blount case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blount, by the way, said, "I think this is unfair. I mean, this is the way we do things down here. I'm not hurting anybody, particularly none of you guys."
I was going to ask about, because there are pockets of resistance to the
still are. And there are guys, I know there are guys getting around it one way or another. Mm-hmm. I know it.
Well, they have to eventually ban the consultants as well.
Yeah, well, they had to, because that was the easiest fix for them in history. I mean, that was the easiest fix of all. and the bond lawyers said, "Don't tell me you're going to bring us in on this." I said, "I am not. Because I don't have any jurisdiction over you. But, you know, maybe someone will." And the consultants, some of the consultants probably would have been part of being part of a scheme. But there are still some guys getting around, and I know that. I know it.
But there again, it's mainly kind of in the, I guess I use the word parochial, corners of the industry.
In the hinterlands.
I much enjoyed your impersonation of Blount.
David, it's, by the way, he pronounces his name Blount.
Blount, I'm sorry.
They all do. B-L-O-U-N-T. Mm-hmm. Great old Alabama name. David, this is the craziest thing I ever come across in my whole life. You're telling me I can't give the governor some money? Yes, I'm telling you. What, come with some of my people? I said, no. You can't give it. He's funny.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. He's, you know, he's not a crook, mm-hmm. really. He's a good, he was good, he's a good, I think he's dead. I think he might be.
Is he?
Bill Blunt, I think he might be. I don't know. I shouldn't say that.
Because they put him in jail eventually.
Yeah, of course.
In prison.
you know, we didn't have many municipal guys go to jail. He wasn't really.
No, I can't imagine it.
He wasn't really a municipal guy. I mean, a firm that did everything. But those firms, a major portion of their income came from doing municipal deals and selling municipal bonds. You know, because, I mean, they have stockbrokers in their employ, most of them anyway. I forgot he'd gone to jail. See, I forgot.
Well, it was quite recently. I mean, it was many years later. After the
was
Supreme
it?
Court.
Was
yeah,
it?
I think it was in, I'd have to look it up, but 2010 or 2011.
Really?
Yeah, it was quite recently. Yeah.
I was probably down here, and they didn't put it in the paper or something.
Yeah, maybe.
They certainly wouldn't run it on NBC News.
It was in connection with the whole Jefferson County.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what he had to do with it, but it's a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
Harrisburg.
Yeah.
Another not good situation. And there are a couple of others. My wife, who you may or may not meet if she gets here, was. Assistant Attorney General of the state of Nevada, and ran the bond business. They didn't have anybody else, and she was smart, and she understood cash flow, which everybody thought was amazing. You mean a woman who understands cash flow? She ran that whole business for the state. And I'm trying to think of, was there anybody? I knew another guy who got in big trouble from Oklahoma. And I think he went to jail, too. But what did they say Blunt had to do with the Jefferson?
That family? I would have to look up. You know, I've noted it down, but many years later.
Yeah. What's Kit doing at the moment?
He's retired. He's in Alexandria, Virginia. I went down to his house.
Yeah, that's where he worked.
Yeah.
Worked from there. Kit was a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Knew how to run that agency, MSRB.
He was there an extraordinarily long time.
He was. When I was chairman, I worked closely with him and thought he was, I always thought he was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Quite good, in fact. He had good staff.
Mm-hmm.
He understood everything and he had good staff.
Was it different working with somebody who is trained as an economist versus the lawyers who tend to be the regulators?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the lawyers, it depends on what lawyer you're talking about, you know. Some were good, very good, and easy to work with. Others were definitely not. My best friend, who roomed with me at Yale, still, to this day, he's my age. He's 77. Actually, yeah, he's 77. I was explaining this to him one day, and he said, I wouldn't understand the first thing about this. I defend people who are charged by the government. But I hate the SEC, you know, naturally. Because they're, you know, I remember when they fined MBIA. He was the first guy that said, "Don't fight it." They're fining you what they think you can pay, without straining you, a lot of money. MBIA, and they got all the cards. You got none. So I remember saying to the rest of my board, I said, "Well, I think the word is we're going to pay," which we did.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one about one particular point that I'm kind of curious about. In the MSRB, of course, they're only allowed to regulate very specific things that are municipal securities. They can't regulate derivatives of municipal securities, that sort of thing. Was that to members of the board, did that seem like those distinctions seem kind of peculiar, that there were some things they could regulate, some things they couldn't, or was it natural in the industry as well?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I would answer that by saying derivatives. See, you have to be a municipal security. If you are a municipal security, they can regulate you. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what it is. And some derivatives are not. And that's, I think, the reason that they can't regulate them. But if you're a municipal security, a swap, for instance, they can regulate you. I believe.
Not swaps.
No. They can't regulate. They don't regulate swaps.
529s they can. I've heard very good, interesting stories about that. We won't get into it.
I don't think anybody thought much about it.
Okay.
For one thing, until we got into...
But let me put it another way. If you're at a broker-dealer, would all those things be run from the same desk? Or, would people at Goldman Sachs who... if there were municipal security-heavy mutual funds or something, I may be not talking sense at all, but or if there were derivatives based upon those things, would those have been under you?
They would have been, although we would be working with either the corporate bond desk or the treasury bond desk, the government bond desk. Mm-hmm. Or we might be.
Do those connections become closer with time?
They're not only closer, all those desks now sit in the same... We had our own floor.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all one thing.
Okay.
The guy who is now has my job, the job I had at Goldman Sachs, is not a municipal guy at all. And I said, you know, he's a good guy, but and he reports, he gives orders to the guys who are the highest ranking municipal guys in the firm, of which there are a few. But see, we were a partnership when I was there. And I actually left before the firm went public, which makes me a much poorer man today than I would be otherwise.
You seem to be doing all right.
Yeah, I'm not complaining.
Looking at your house, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, there would be some, there'd be interactive, because I'll tell you why. Sometimes we had to, for instance, when I did a couple of bond deals where I collateralized treasury bonds, my treasury bond desk had to price those things, and that's not like a derivative at all, but it's I guess it's sort of the same kind of thing, because we didn't have the capability of doing that. We weren't allowed to deal in those kinds of things. In the end, you know, I think that the business will, you know, this is the only country in the world where you can do 100% financing of a project, do it serial up to 30 years, and have it be tax-free. I mean, this, you know, when I talked to a friend of mine from Germany, he said to me, "You're kidding." He said, "Here, 8 or 9 year deals look to be very long, and we don't have any tax free anything." I said, "Well, there you go." So I think the business will do fine over a long period of time, forever.
Yeah.
And the only difference is that now we don't have the kinds of specialists. Just we do though. I mean, we have investment bankers who go and sell deals, and if you're looking Monday morning for what's supposed to sell that week, you'll see, you know, Goldman Sachs, Goldman Sachs. We're managing deals. And the volume is still pretty good, pretty big, pretty good in municipals. It goes up and down with rates, but it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about for Goldman Sachs specifically. I know that they've gone pretty much up with the total volume of sales.
It's gone up.
Extraordinary. I mean,
since you retired. It went down a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And but it's mostly it'll go on because these people need to finance their projects, and that's the way they do it.
Mm-hmm.
They can't. Nobody want. People would prefer not to raise taxes to do this kind of thing. When you get right down to it, other than, I mean, you know, a project is a project. It has to be built. You have to have money, et cetera, et cetera. It's not, you know, you can't. So you could raise taxes, accumulate the money, and do it, but not very popular among the body politic.
Mm-hmm. So then you retired in, what was it, 1994?
I think so. It's on my thing.
Right.
Around four there. Or five, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think 94, that's dated, and then I was there not doing anything for a couple of years. Something they call, I think they still do have them. I know they do.
Mm-hmm.
What they call us. I don't know. It's what guys who retired as partners. We're now retired partners, which is our. It's a title. But it's just guys who were partners.
Was that a more general period of transition for Goldman Sachs? I was reading the news story on your retirement, and they said there were a number of other people moving on around that time.
There's a news story in my retirement.
Yeah, it wasn't terribly long, but it exists. It exists. It might have been the bond buyer.
The bond buyer probably would have had it. I don't think it was. I mean, I think that what happened was the firm is so different from when I was there. First of all, when it was a partnership, it was. There was an understood way of doing things and how you did them, and there was a great deal of pride, et cetera, et cetera. I still think there is, but I feel like the firm is huge, and it's.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was made a partner of the firm, now this does not take into account who might have retired, but I think I was partner number 52. Now there's like 3,000. it boggles the mind. I went up. All my securities business is still done there. So I was going up in the elevator with my wife, and the guy does the work, and a couple of guys come on. And he said, I want to introduce you to David Clapp. And he said, David Clapp, the partner? And I said, yes! Well, sir, you were of some renown. I said, thanks for saying that. Connie said to me after my wife said, well, they remember you somebody. it's the building, the new building.
Mm-hmm.
It's a $1 billion. I mean, it's an unbelievable building. It's unbelievable. And the management of the firm is fabulous. It was fabulous always, and it still is fabulous. And no less a person than Warren Buffett, who owns NetJets, and I'm a NetJet partial owner of an aircraft, told me at a dinner that Lloyd Blankfein, who now runs Goldman Sachs, he says, he's the smartest person I ever met. Just like Bob Rubin told me that Bill Clinton was the smartest guy he ever met. So you never, you know.
Yeah.
That's the same Bob Rubin who said to me once, this clown can't get elected president.
Same guy?
Same guy. Well, we got to know him when he was Treasury Secretary.
Yeah.
He knew him then, but in any event.
So you joined the board then of the MBIA.
I was already on the MBIA.
Oh, you were?
Okay. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, it was simultaneous. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
And I was on there for 9 years, whatever it was. The chairman called me one day and said, what do you think? And I said, I think it's time for me to go. He said, you know, when I went on that board, I think I knew as much about municipal bonds and municipal bond business as anyone, and I was a municipal bond insurer. But over time, with all the other products that they got, the ones that got them in trouble, mm-hmm. and all the rest of this stuff, I didn't need to be, they didn't need somebody with my particular expertise anymore. You know, I don't think it was, so anyway, that's when I got off. And that was enjoyable too.
So in general, you've kept tabs on the industry, but not intensely involved.
I'd say that's a good description of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Couple of my best friends are still involved, and we get together now and again and talk, and this, that, and the other thing. And one of the fellows who worked for me, who later went to Tokyo for Goldman Sachs, who worked for me at Goldman Sachs, for one point, lives here on this campus, you know. So I see him reasonably frequently. But we're getting old. Well,
yeah, that's a pretty good interview on the whole. Is there anything you'd like to say to wrap up?
No, I don't. I think that... you've asked a lot of good questions, and what you've done is sort of reminded me, which I haven't done so much thinking about the, you know, whether it's Whoops or New York City or this or that, reminded me of some things that were sort of the points of greatest interest during my time in the business. And I think that we came out of all those things in pretty darn good shape, with an awful lot of good cooperation by a lot of good people. And I, you know, as I said earlier, it's not 100% true, of course, but I think most of the people who work on the public servant side of the business are pretty good. Pretty good, pretty smart, pretty dedicated. And I think without them, there'd be a lot more problems than there are. When you think about it, there aren't many problems.
Mm-hmm.
Something about Meredith Whitney. Do you remember Meredith Whitney?
I don't.
You don't know who she is?
I don't think so.
Okay, she's an analyst. 2 years, and she's very well known. She originally called the Citibank, the problems at Citibank, in terms of being undercapitalized. Then, about 2 years ago, she said, this year, hundreds and hundreds of municipalities are going to default and cost investors hundreds of millions of dollars. Flat wrong, dead wrong. And somebody said to me, how do you think she could say that? And I said, let me tell you what I think it is. I think it's bad staff work. I said, because somebody who works for her or with her should have said to her, don't say that. That's not going to happen. You don't understand the laws of these states well enough. Let's see if this is... Is that all right? Did you get everything you needed? Or?
Yes, I think so. It was very good. I don't think we had another person who was actually in the industry on our list of people to talk to, and it was a very good perspective to get, I think. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, I was pleased to do it.